On Tuesday, October 3rd, 2023, as part of their Banned Books Week celebration, the Bozeman Public Library hosted members of the Montana Free Press for a discussion of bills from the 2023 Montana legislative session that impacted the First Amendment in the library, including House Bill 234 and House Bill 359. The presentation was held in the community room at the library.
Hi, everyone.
Hi.
I'm Liz DeVries. I am a adult programming and outreach librarian here at the Bozeman Public Library. It's great to see so many of you take an interest in this program tonight. The purpose of this program is to give you a little bit more information about what's happened this year in Montana libraries as it relates to the last legislature session. The goal is to inform you about HB 234 and HB 359 and what's happening now with them. Nothing you hear tonight is legal advice. This program is for information only, and the library does not endorse or promote any one viewpoint. This program is designed to give everyone a chance to ask questions. You'll find on your seats pens and note cards for you to write out questions. I'll be floating around to pick them up, and you can pass them on to our moderator. So I'd like to introduce our guests tonight. We have Aaron Kimball Sannett. He's from Arizona. Before he joined the Montana Free Press covering politics, he worked as a State House reporter for the Arizona Capital Times and in Washington, D.C. with Politico, where he covered agricultural and trade policies. Aaron is interested in the politics of land, housing, and transportation. We have Alex Sackerson, who is originally from North Dakota and is an education reporter. He spent the last 10 years writing long-form narratives about politics, people, and the wilds of Montana, while also exploring Montana's ski slopes and rivers. Our moderator this evening is Nick Eli, a local correspondent for Montana Free Press. He has 30 years of experience working in Montana newspapers and was the founding editor-in-chief for Montana Quarterly, as well as an editor for your very own Bozeman Daily Chronicle.
Yeah.
All right. I'll let you take it away.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate you being here tonight. I want to take just a moment, if you would indulge me, to thank the library for putting on this event. Their continued commitment to talking about banned books and issues like this is really a service to our community. And so thank you to the library for doing that. As this event has been drawing near, I've been thinking a lot about banned books and why they matter. And more specifically for me, thinking about the banned books that have made a difference to me and how I see the world and have changed my perspective. And more so along that line, thinking then about specifically a book called The Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Good. Book I highly recommend. Ellison published this book in 1952, so basically 70 years ago, that chronicled the realities of discrimination, racial discrimination in America, and changed a lot of the way that people think about discrimination. It did that for me. This has been an important book for me that really made me think about banned books and why we should read things and why people maybe don't want us to read certain things. I am was born, raised, and educated in Montana. I am a middle-aged white man, right? I have I've never gone to bed at night hungry. I've never had to think about whether the water coming out of my faucet was going to be safe for my kids. I've never had to think, okay, if I get pulled over tonight on the way home with a broken taillight, where do I put my hands on the steering wheel? I'm really the definition of privilege, and that's just how that is. That's not an apology, and I don't mean it as one, but I do think it's recognition that I simply can't relate to the characters in Ellison's book. I just can't. But I think through reading books like that, I can hope to learn, understand what it's like to walk in another person's shoes that's maybe lived a different experience than mine. I think doing that, reading books like that, empathy becomes possible, compassion becomes possible. And hopefully, change becomes possible. And so I promise this will be my only editorial comment for the night, and then I'll stop. But books like this should not be banned. They should be. I'm probably preaching to the crowd at the library, but
controversial.
Should not be banned. They should really be read, held up, celebrated. And I think that that's a thing that we should strive for. So again, thanks to the library for this event. It's important for our community to have these types of discussions. I do want to reiterate Liz's point that before I turn things over to Alex and to Arne, that we are not lawyers or judges. Thankful for that. So we won't be making any legal advice to you this evening about these particular bills, but more to help you maybe understand what's all behind them. Let's see, these particular pieces of legislation are not settled law. There's still quite a bit going on with each of these bills, and I think that we'll be able to get you up to date on where those things are at. All right, please, we hope that you'll be involved in this conversation with us tonight, and feel free to write down any questions that you have, and we'll gather those up and hopefully bring them around so we can incorporate those into our discussion tonight. So first off, I'm going to turn things over to Arne, who's going to talk to us about the dynamics at play in the legislature, the politics that were behind some of these pieces of legislation, and we'll just take it from there. So, Arne.
Hi, guys, and thanks all for coming out. Again, my name is Arne Kimball-Sanit. I'm the main politics reporter at the Free Press. You guys seem like a pretty civically engaged crowd. Are people reasonably familiar with the legislative process here? So just for those of you maybe listening elsewhere, basically, it's a pretty simple process, schoolhouse rock stuff. A lot of these ideas, come from legislators' heads. Many of them come from outside groups, organizations in other states that write model legislation. A lot of the hot-button, socially conservative legislation that we've seen this session is of that nature, if not literally model legislation, very much inspired by things that Republicans have been doing in other states. Basically, a bill starts as an idea, goes through a drafting process that is facilitated by legislative staff, and then gets voted on through a series of committees and floor votes. Along the way, it's amended. Lots of shenanigans go on behind the scenes, and then at some point, that bill becomes law after, as you guys know, probably it gets signed by the governor. And that is the status of both of these bills. It became law, and then very quickly we're subject to legal challenges. And hence Nick's comment about these not being settled law. The drag story hour bill, as Alex will talk about in a bit, is not in effect anywhere in the state. It's subject to a temporary restraining order. Just to give a sense of what the legislature looked like this year. So I guess to sort of understand it, it's helpful to go back to 2021, or really 2020, when Montanans elected a Republican governor for the first time in 16 years, as well as a almost unprecedented Republican majority in the legislature, and Republicans to every other statewide office, like the Attorney General and the Secretary of State, which basically created an environment where there was a floodgate of bills that, generally speaking, had been vetoed or just not passed because people knew they would be vetoed under Democratic governors, Schweitzer and Bullock, for almost two decades. So that was the sort of context in 2021. And then in 2023, Republicans increased their legislative margin by two seats, I think, which gave them what we call a two-thirds supermajority. And the reason that that's significant is because they can make really sweeping changes, or at least can propose really sweeping changes to things like the Constitution without needing buy-in from votes from Democrats. So you have this sort of newly unrestrained, Montana's legislature has had a Republican majority since, I think, 2011. So that is itself not new. But the permission structure, the leadership in the governor's office, that all changed in 2020 and created this environment where Montana, which, as you guys know, is famously a more or less purple state, it became, a now sort of model, cutting-edge conservative state in terms of the kinds of policies it was passing. We're still not as far to the right, or at least we haven't passed as many laws that indicate a rightward shift as our neighbors in Wyoming and Idaho which, you know, have not generally had Democratic governors in recent years. It became a situation where there was all of this energy, both AstroTurf as well as grassroots, among mostly older, politically engaged, religious conservatives that had not really found a foothold in recent years in Montana. And then that really changed in 2021. In 2023, they saw that the policies that they were passing were apparently resonating with voters, at least enough to keep winning legislative races. And so with a few more seats under their belt and the continued reign of Republicans in statewide office, as well as, of course, in D.C., with the exception of John Tester, I think we saw that even more amplified. And I think an interesting point to emphasize in all of this is the role of the courts. As Alex is going to discuss, this is like a big part of this whole thing, because the courts in Montana officially are nonpartisan. You know, people can dispute that, but they're really the last, like, I often write in stories that Montana right now is at this point where there is a conservative, not in its politics, but in its positioning, a conservative court that has been doing things the same way under a constitution that was written in the 70s for basically a long time. And some of these guys are former Republican legislators or former Democratic legislators, but generally speaking, they have operated as sort of a unit. They seem in their politics and policy approach to be pretty aligned, and their whole existence is undergirded by the 72 Constitution, which, as you guys probably know, is like a fairly progressive document. Like, I don't think that's not a value judgment of mine. I think that's well known. And they are kind of, and on the other hand, you have, I get really sweaty when I talk. On the other hand, you have and this insurgent, I don't mean that in like they're terrorists, but like they are a surging group, a political movement in the Republican Party that is butting heads with this small C conservative institution in the Montana Supreme Court and the Montana Constitution. And you may have heard some Republicans openly criticize the Constitution, which of course they're allowed to do. It's a document that's meant to be changed and, you know, rewritten wholesale if they so choose, as was done in the 70s. But that has meant that a big part of the political environment in the legislature is not only about passing conservative policies, it's also about demonizing, vilifying, and attempting to overhaul and reshape the functions of the court in a way that, I mean, I think Republicans will be fairly honest about the fact that they think that there's a lot of liberals in the judiciary. By some metric, that's probably true. I mean, again, most judges are appointed by the governor. We've had almost two decades of Democratic governors. Ergo, most of the judiciary was appointed by Democrats. So, there's a reason why they say that, right? But what that has meant is that they're extremely critical of the courts. They have attempted to curtail the court's authority. Some have gone out and said, basically, Marbury versus Madison was wrongly decided, and courts shouldn't have the power of judicial review over legislative enactments. So on and so forth. So I think that's sort of the environment that we have right now. It's an insurgent political force, a dominant political force in the Montana Republican Party, going up against a state that has been ruled by the way things are done for like three decades, and a lot of major institutional players in the state, like the court, are pretty uncomfortable with that. So that is sort of the environment that, you know, I think some of these bills were born into. And I think Alex is going to talk more about the bills.
I'll draw my cheat sheet. I don't quite need that yet. Yeah, so, and the two bills that we're talking about now really kind of came out of, as Arne indicated, this sense of an opportunity with, you know, a Republican administration, a Republican supermajority to really start to change some things culturally in the state. House Bill 234 was an interesting story. That's actually not currently under litigation. A lot of the initial critics of that bill will now tell you that it's largely benign due to some changes in the Senate. But that's the infamous obscenity bill. And so House Bill 234, which arose out, started over in the House, proved a bit problematic at first. I talked a lot with a lot of people in the public education sphere and the lawmaking sphere who were like, we tried to do something, something tried to be done a certain way, and they kind of mucked it up. And I'm sorry, I'm prattling on. I'll get around to the point in a second. So what House Bill 234 initially did was revisit a law that was passed in the late 80s that really kind of alleviated a lot of concern that libraries in particular had in regards to obscenity laws for commercial outfits. So this is, if you think like all the Playboy magazines behind the gas station counter need to have that cover, there was a really big push in the 80s to, you know, limit the exposure of minors to, you know, obscene material in commercial, at commercial newsstands, in grocery stores, gas stations, wherever they happen to be. Well, there was some concern among libraries that they might be seen or interpreted as commercial entities in some way. And so they changed this law to stipulate, back in the late 80s, early 90s, that libraries, public schools, were not commercial establishments. And when Representative Bob Phelan, a Republican out of Lindsay, decided, you know, we want to kind of crack down on, you know, sexually explicit material, exposure to, you know, people under the age of 18, they rewrote this in a way that suddenly inserted libraries, schools, into, and museums, into that first section, kind of removed a lot of that "these are not commercial establishments" language. It got kicked over to the Senate. They realized their mistake. They went back. They fixed it to basically outline, no, librarians, public school teachers, everybody, they're subject to the same general obscenity laws that every other Montanan in the state is. If you intentionally, you know, give pornography to a minor, that violates that law. It doesn't matter if you're a public school teacher. There was a lot of debate about what is obscenity, you know, and that kind of bubbled around the legislature a lot. But ultimately, you know, this bill was resolved in the Senate in a way that everybody could kind of live with it. And it just sort of, I guess, tweaked the law in a way that everybody felt comfortable saying, yeah, this basically just says what we've been doing all along. And it also kind of, you know, speaks to some of the concerns that more conservative members of the legislature had. And so that bill's kind of become a big, as we say in our newsroom, nothing burger, in a way. But House Bill 359 very quickly became a big issue, and that was the drag show ban. And that kind of arose, a lot of the proponents had very personal and in many cases religious objections to what they would call sexualized or adult-oriented performances, materials being presented to minors. And there was a lot of pushback from the LGBTQ community, from libraries, from public school teachers, saying, listen, this language is too broad. You're cracking down on some stuff here that we're maybe not even quite doing. Because what wound up being a really big pinch point, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Aaron, is that the definitions of themselves in the law, they were really struggling with how to define drag in a legal way. And that's when words like glamorous and flamboyant came in.
Areola.
Yes. a lot of this, the Senate tried to fix this in a way, and they actually removed a lot of the language that advocates were finding to be problematic, too vague. And
they removed any reference to the word drag.
Exactly. But then it got kicked back over to the House for what's called reconciliation. That's when you get a conference committee. You've got basically the House passes one version, the Senate changes it a bunch. So then they got to work together to make this bill work, right? And they wound up not only inserting a lot of that language back in, but explicitly inserting the phrase drag story hour into it. And this is when it became, you know, an even bigger problem. There was a lot of telegraphing or a lot of prognostication in the latter days of the session that this was going to generate litigation. And Montana's not alone in this. Tennessee passed a similar bill, legislation there. That bill's also on hold. Actually, I was just texting in reference to the Montana bill. There is a request for a preliminary injunction, and as of like 20 minutes before we started this, one of the attorneys told me, like, still no ruling on that from the judge, but there is a temporary restraining order. And so Tennessee and Montana have both blocked those bills. There have been a couple other bills that are a little less specific in their wording that have cropped up in Florida, Arkansas, North Dakota. A weird situation just happened last month in Texas where you had a judge basically rule the other way. And this was in regards to an issue with a college campus. So Texas A&M had canceled, the president had canceled this student-led drag event. They filed a lawsuit. The judge said, nope, president, university president was totally within his grounds to do that. So, and this is all happening in the federal court because a lot of the arguments against these bills are First Amendment arguments. They're saying, listen, this is a form of expression among people who, you know, identify a certain way. And, you know, you can't just blanket crack down on that. That's a violation of our First Amendment rights under the U.S. Constitution. So this is all playing out in federal courts, unlike a lot of the other issues with other bills from this session, completely unrelated to, you know, drag story hours and stuff that are playing out in the state court level and will likely wind up at the state Supreme Court, like a lot of legislation from 2021. And so I'm trying to think of anything I'm missing. I guess with 359, the drag show ban, the big argument or the big kind of tipping point that happened for that bill that convinced the judge to issue the temporary restraining order was the Pride event in Helena. There were a lot of concerns. Event runners were having a hard time getting permits for certain events because a lot of venues were saying, we don't know if we're going to get sued under this law or not. The language is vague enough that it exposes us to potential legal liability or legal issues, legal challenges, if we go forward with this. And there's a bit of a precedent for that in Butte Silverbow, where the library had, at the advice of the county attorney's office, canceled a lecture on Indigenous and Two-Spirit history by Adria Jaworek, who is a plaintiff in the lawsuit, as a result of this, but a Northern Cheyenne tribal member and a transgender woman, an activist. And
that event, correct me if I'm wrong, had no drag as a part of it.
It had no drag as a part of it, but, you know, going through, I've got the partial quote written here, but the county in its cancellation email to Adria, who included this in her declaration to the court in the lawsuit, said that it was, quote, too much of a risk to have a trans person in the library. Under 359. So you can see where a lot of the vagary in this language is generating a lot of sort of, it's what the court and a lot of the plaintiffs have referred to as a chilling effect. And it's just, it's, you know, it happens a lot when you've got, you know, an unresolved legal question. You know, does this count as a drag show or does it not? Does this count as, you know, the sexually oriented or adult-oriented performance, or does it not? And the legislature, you know, just, I think, left this up to the courts in a lot of ways.
So, Alex, can you tell us, and I'm not sure if you know this or not, of at what point did the injunction, the temporary injunction, take place? Was it before what was happening in these other communities or after the fact?
So it was after Adria's event was canceled, but it was just prior to the Pride Week events in Helena. Mm-hmm. And that was a big factor in the timing. So a lot of the businesses in Helena kind of took a chance anyway, but it was literally like, you know, at the same time that event organizers were trying to secure these permits, that TRO came out.
So could you maybe explain to folks a little bit? So there's a TRO that's a little easier to get than what they're asking at this point. Can you maybe explain the two differences of those things?
So temporary restraining order is it's easy, as you say, it's easier to get, but it's also not quite as binding as a preliminary injunction, which you know, if a judge issues a preliminary injunction, that basically says until this is resolved by this court, this we're blocking the enforcement of this. I'm going to let Arne jump in.
So like the thing with the TRO is that you're supposed to be able to prove that there would be immediate harm if the judge does not act in the extremely short term to effectively what all of these orders do is preserve the status quo. That's the legal term of art, right? So a TRO is something that would happen in the very early stages of a lawsuit if a plaintiff who's asking for the TRO can prove not with... I forgot exactly what the standard is. Basically, it's a diminished legal standard, but you're supposed to be able to prove to the judge that there will be immediate harm to me or to the causes that I represent if this change, whether that be a law, which is the case that we're talking about. But a TRO can be applied in any kind of litigation. It's not only for bills. A preliminary injunction is basically the next step, and it doesn't necessarily require a TRO to exist, because again, the idea with the TRO is that there's immediate harm. And that was the idea here. Like, the city of Helena employed kind of an interesting legal strategy. They became an intervener in this lawsuit and said, and like, if you guys know anything about the city of Helena, like, they're not opposed to drag. It's a pretty liberal city, right? But they said, basically, they tried to force a judge to declare a TRO by saying, we will not provide these permits if this law is in effect come this weekend when Montana Pride happens. Because the whole thing with Helena Pride, if you've been to Montana Pride in Helena, is that there's a drag show on the street, which is, a publicly operated thing, which would be covered under the text of the bill. So a preliminary injunction is the step that they're currently litigating, and even that does not necessarily have any bearing on whether the judge will ultimately determine whether this law is legal. And even if it does, of course, it can be appealed up the way. And another interesting note, this is just like kind of a fun fact, I guess. One of the reasons that the filing of this lawsuit in federal court is interesting, as Alex said, it's pretty obviously a First Amendment issue, which is in the U.S. Constitution, if any of you have forgotten, is also that it's very difficult to obtain lawyer's fees in state court. So the plaintiff's attorneys, Upper Seven Law, in this case, will be able to make the state pay if they attorney's fees if they win in federal court, which is just sort of another negative incentive against the state passing these kinds of laws that doesn't really exist in state court. Because in state court, there's not really any downside for lawmakers to pass these things. Because a lot of them believe in these laws, right? But a lot of them don't. and it's kind of like a go-along-to-get-along mentality. And they're not super concerned even when their own lawyers tell them that this might not be constitutional, because they don't have to pay if the state court rules that way. On some level, it's beneficial to them because they can come back the next session and rewrite the law in a way that they feel might comply with what the state court says. So the federal jurisdiction in this particular piece of litigation over this particular piece of legislation is a really important part. Just as a reminder, this law is not currently in effect, but it has not been enjoined. It has only been restrained. And even when it is enjoined, it still may end up being law, depending on how the court disposes of it finally. So that is sort of the state of play currently. I think another interesting thing about the federal court is that it allows the plaintiffs to attempt to kind of sidestep the inevitable response from Republicans that these are biased state judges that are ruling on these laws. So yeah, it's a really fascinating case from like a legal perspective, setting aside the potential constitutional and sort of human issues. But that is a brief and not entirely accurate overview of how the courts in Montana work.
So Arne, would you expect that because this is in federal court, that no matter how the judge rules on this, that appeals would go to the Ninth Circuit? Is that most likely?
Are we in the Ninth Circuit?
We are.
Yes, probably. I just tell you the truth again. We're not lawyers. I don't really know.
So fair enough. But that would seem like, and you mentioned this, that the arguments that we're hearing a lot in state court is that these are the rulings are coming out of liberal judges. Mm-hmm.
Right. And Republicans often critique the Ninth Circuit as being the most liberal appeals.
The most liberal appeals court.
Right? It is.
Yeah, I mean, it is. You know, it's funny. It's just as a brief aside, you know, you hear people in the state a lot say, when Republicans say, oh, the court is so liberal, say, oh, no, that's not possible. But, like, it is possible, right? Like, things can be true and not necessarily bad. Just acknowledging that the courts rule in some way that aligns with the political philosophy, like, I don't think has to be a bad thing necessarily, because it doesn't necessarily mean that they're not ruling in the way that the law says, but different people with different political persuasions will interpret the law differently. And it's not a secret to anybody, I don't think, that the Ninth Circuit is going to be more liberal than an appeals court that is based in the South, right? It's just a fact of political geography. And Montana is in kind of like a similar position. Like, it's, as I said, it's not a secret that we had a Democratic governor who has the power to appoint judges for 16 years. Like, that has a material effect on the legal and political landscape. And I think it's a little silly to pretend that it doesn't, and that these guys are just like computers that are fed a bunch of legal facts and spit out an outcome. Like, they are people who do have personal politics as much as they might strenuously deny it.
So do the, to where this is going to be decided, is that the lawyers for the plaintiffs that decide that they're going to file this in federal court? Or is it just because it's a First Amendment issue that that's where it likely...
I think they could have filed it in state court if they wanted to.
Well, it depends, yeah. To some degree, it depends on what grounds they challenge it. So, like, what we're seeing with, you know, other challenges with the House Bill 562, which is one that I've been covering a lot, it's the... community choice schools, one of the two charter school bills that passed this session. They challenged that on grounds related to the Montana Constitution. And so it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to file that in a federal court. You know, it makes more sense to file that in a state district court and ultimately have the Montana State Supreme Court decide something on the Montana Constitution. But if you've got a First Amendment U.S. Constitution question, that kind of opens you up to be able to go, okay, well, maybe this is a federal question. It requires a federal level judge to look at these facts and weigh in on this issue. Okay. So to some degree, it falls to...
All right, thanks. I've been wondering about that. I'm curious a little bit how this... when this came up in the legislature, it struck me as, when we're talking about needing to stop drag shows in libraries and public places... Was this an issue in search of a problem? I mean, were there drag shows at libraries beforehand? I don't know if that was something that came up during the legislative session or not.
It did come up, and there have been a lot of folks. I mean, I've talked to members of the Montana Library Association who have said, like, we haven't been doing like drag shows in libraries. But I also don't want to, you know, discount the, I mean, there are a lot of folks who, I think this feeds into a deeper cultural question that we're facing right now. And it's not just Montana, this is playing out all over the country. And it's, I cover it mostly through the lens of public education, but it's also now spilled over onto the plates of libraries, where you have, you know, a very active, very engaged and you know, group, segment of the population with a very certain belief set. And that at times is at odds with the belief set of others. I mean, I said this in I characterized it this way in an article earlier this year on, you know, kind of the broader culture wars at play in libraries in Montana, that, you know, a lot of librarians really have, like, you know, freedom of information, freedom of access, you know, in their bones. It's a big part of what they do. They give people access to information. And there is certain information that, you know, certain members of the public don't think is appropriate for people of a certain age. During testimony on the obscenity bill on House Bill 234, activists in the parental rights movement here had, you know, said that this is a question of the purity of young hearts and minds. And so, you know, it's a very deep belief. And I think that the perception here is in part a driver more than it being a solution in search of a problem. I think it feeds into a broader sort of cultural clash that we're experiencing at a national level now. It just so happens that, you know, transgender rights have been swept up in this, in, you know, along with a whole slate of other issues.
And it's also, I mean, worth pointing out that drag shows are part of it, but it's the drag story hour that is like the library nexus and the school's nexus that the bill is targeting specifically. And I don't know if you guys have done one or if other libraries have, but I mean that is a thing that has happened, right? So it's less the drag. It became a drag band in common parlance, and because of the broad definitions of drag and public and things like that in the bill, it, you know, sort of is, but it's more, at least in its inception, you know, I think probably more about the story hours than it is specifically drag shows. And I actually have a question for Alex. I mean, a big part of this too, right, is that library and school boards are now sort of like a venue of political conflict that maybe they were not as much recently.
Well, yeah, I mean, we certainly see that play out. Seen that play out in Billings, Bozeman, Missoula, the Flathead. I was thinking with school boards in the 2022 cycle. Yeah, I believe that's why I covered it. I think Nick, you edited that.
I think
story,
that's right.
So I'm trying to remember. It's been a long year. But yeah, I mean, a lot of folks have pointed as well to the Imagine If Library in Kalispell, where, you know, that board, the board of trustees there, you know, has a majority of its members of, you know, a certain political and cultural persuasion. And they're making decisions, you know, through that lens. And this has, we saw it less this year with school board races, but, you know, school board elections became across the country in the last couple of years a real flashpoint. And I remember talking to several school board trustees, longtime school board trustees in Missoula a year or so ago, who said, yeah, you know, we used to have to like go to pains, beg people, one person just to run for an open seat. And then all of a sudden they had five candidates vying for one seat to oust an incumbent. And it very much fed into a lot of the issues that, I mean, 234 wasn't, you know, had little or nothing to do with drag. It had everything to do with books like Genderqueer and Lawn Boy, a lot of these, you know, books that we're hearing about at the national level that, you know, that the parental rights movement in particular feels are not suitable for minors. And so they want certain action at like the school board level, because Montana is a local control state. A lot of decisions about what happens in a public school district get made at the local level. It's not OPI sending orders down. It's the Office of Public Instruction. A lot of decisions about, you know, classroom content and stuff are hashed out at the school board trustee level. And so if you want to change things in a certain way, if you want to have the public school system or the materials in a classroom reflect a certain viewpoint, that's where you run politically. That's where you, you know, consolidate, you know, any sort of power you want. So, yeah, it feeds into that a lot.
Well, and I've often thought this, that if you want to really make a difference in how your community runs, you're going to have a lot more effect running for the school board or city commission as opposed to running for Congress. Congressman from Montana is going to have very little say in what happens in Montana, where local school board, local city commission, all those things make a much bigger difference in what happens in our communities.
Well, we're seeing it on a lot of different, you know, areas that have been politicized. I mean, I've been covering this on the election administration front too. I mean, the election administrators, county clerks, have become just this past election cycle, the county clerk and recorder became a huge, you know, like a battleground politically in campaigns. And it was because if you want your elections to look a certain way, that's where you can, you know, make a change. And yeah.
I've got a couple part question for you, Alex. I'm curious about with House Bill 234, did that set out to define obscenity? And the second part of that question, if it makes it illegal for people to provide sexually explicit material to minors, is that why this is a nothing burger? Didn't we always have that law? I've been confused about 234's purpose.
I 234, I mean, that was an interesting one where there seemed to be, you know, a desire to pursue a certain change, and the obscenity law was, I guess, identified as the best avenue to do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, the initial draft of the bill tried to tackle this in a way that, like, legislative services wound up going, oops. Like, this isn't how we should how we should have done this. I mean, we changed a part of the law that it made zero sense. And so it didn't try to touch the bill never really tried to get into redefining what obscenity is. It more tried to expand the application of that, or I guess more clearly stipulate that, you know, this type of material in the hands of, you know, in a public school setting, in a library setting, is not something that the proponents of this bill want.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think, yeah.
It's going back to the drafting process. I mean, like, legislators, with some exceptions, you know, like us, are not lawyers, right? And don't always know what legal change they are in search of. They know the moral or the political change they would like to see, which, I mean, we can broadly define, I think, this current moment as in Republican politics as being opposed to LGBTQ rights and expression. Like, I don't think they would deny that. And the nexus that they identified was, you know, it's like Facebook politics, basically, right? Like, they saw a post from somebody's aunt about genderqueer in Connecticut or whatever, and then started thinking about it. Oh, hey, that's kind of screwed up. Like, why are we teaching kids how to masturbate, you know? Like, and then they figured out that they are legislators and they have the power to do something. They're not always clear about what. And then they send these ideas, which, like, and if you can file public records requests for, like, the drafting notes and documents. In many cases, they are literally handwritten forms that legislators write that say, I want to do this. And then they give it to staff, and it's like one sentence, and then it's up to staff to figure out how to write the bill in a way that satisfies lawmakers' requests, gets close enough to being legal, and doesn't get them in trouble, right? Because legislative staff also have personal beliefs about these things that they're not supposed to express. So it's a really interesting sort of formula that leads to laws that, like this one, have kind of unspecific impact that can make people who wanted to propose these bills happy without maybe actually accomplishing that much in, like, a practical sense. But it sets the message, right, that this is what we want to see in our state and this is what we won't tolerate.
So do those, when those laws are getting written by staff, do they also include for legislatures notes that say, hey, beware, this is likely going to be legally challenged and we're likely going to lose?
Legal notes pop up on bills. I wouldn't say regularly, but they have, particularly on bills that are driving a lot of debate, and it raised some pretty obvious legal questions, that's when the legislative legal division kind of gets involved, and that you wind up with a legal note that we have typically been able to access mm-hmm. pretty easily. And that just lays out, and it's not a binding decision or anything, but it says, you know, this bill would in reality do this, and so it may run afoul of this law or this section of the Montana Constitution, and kind of lays it out that way.
And so lawmakers have to pick and choose of that whether they want to let that influence whether they go forward or not, mm-hmm. obviously. Mm-hmm. That's
exactly.
Still up
and,
to them.
And that's weighed up against it. And the thing I wanted to kind of add to what Aaron was saying is that a lot of times, too, these lawmakers are hearing from constituents who are very engaged, very active on a particular issue. And these happen to be, like, the issues that these bills sought to address were generating a lot of, like, activity by groups like Moms for Liberty and, their chapter out of Billings. Alba Pimentel, one of their leaders, was at pretty much every hearing testifying on this. There are some activists from Bozeman, too, who were, from the parental rights movement, and they're in the room or on Zoom consistently, saying this is part of our sort of grassroots mission to, see this change implemented. And so, a lawmaker's got an idea to do something or has heard something from constituents, and then all of a sudden a bunch more constituents start coming up, and they go, oh, this is a big deal. And they push.
Because we heard about it in a legislative hearing. The idea of there being feedback loops and permission structures in the legislature is extraordinarily important, because not everybody just knows everything at the same time, right? But once you start saying things in legislative hearings, then it's a matter of public record. And then you repeat it over and over and over and over again through all the different hearings, and you have all the same people testifying. And then that builds momentum because these clips get posted online. I mean, Moms for Liberty is a very online group. Liberty? Yeah. And the whole, quote-unquote, parental rights, the sort of conservative curriculum movement is a very online phenomenon. And so these ideas get disseminated in a way that makes them feel real to people, even when they are not always, even when the things that they are attacking don't always exist.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense. I want to point out, if you haven't read Alex's piece on cultural wars in Montana, I really recommend it. When did that run? A couple months ago now?
August. Mm-hmm. Reading Between the Lines, I think.
Yeah.
Brilliant headline. Thank you, Brad.
That was Nick.
Yeah, whichever editor came up with that.
If you're interested in learning more about that whole phenomenon, that story is super well written, super deeply reported, and it's the type of work that I guess Montana Free Press really strives to do. Mm-hmm. And I would hold it up as some of the best work, I think, that we've done this year. So good for Alex on that. We're going to start gathering up questions if you've got them. My other job that I have in this community is I teach in the Honors College at Montana State, and I teach freshmen. And I have been grading freshman blue book essays all day. So this handwriting is so lovely. I can't tell you how easy it is to read. There was a point today when I had, honey, would you please come into my office and tell me what this word says? I can't read it. All right, so this is a question from the audience. Thank you. During discussion in the legislature, did anyone mention the fact that many Shakespeare plays and many classic operas involve characters impersonating the opposite sex? Did that come up? Yes.
Thanks, all right. I'll just keep talking, I guess. Yes, that did come up. A lot of classic literary examples came up. And in fact, one of the most interesting, I think, bits of testimony that happened early on the obscenity bill was a Baptist minister coming on saying, look, there are examples of rape and incest and everything in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And if we're concerned about this having a chilling effect on, library collections, librarians going through their collections going, oh, crap, I've
this obscenity law now applies to everything, so we got to clear out, is the Bible going to be safe? And so, yeah, I mean, there were a lot of, you know, citations of, like, literary examples that would prove problematic.
And the proponents, I mean, denied that that was the intended effect, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Did it affect how legislators, you think, viewed this?
No.
not that I know firsthand.
Okay, fair enough.
I'll say that.
Okay, moving on. This question. What does temporary restraining order mean? And this asks in terms of House Bill 234, which, if I'm reading it right, doesn't have that.
359 is the one.
But 359 does. But what does it mean in temporary? Is that 30 days?
I'm a lawyer. I can answer that.
Let's stick with the group.
Us idiots up here. I mean, I think we kind of hit that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, is a TRO isn't set by time. It's set by when the judge rules. Is that fair? I mean, it's not.
He's nodding. We're good.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
We need immediate irreparable harm for a TRO.
Which is
fine. Like, we can't have a parole. That's immediate and irreparable.
Gotcha.
Now, right. But now the parade is over, he could withdraw the TRO.
But that had, from what I know, that hasn't happened.
Yeah. No motion to that effect exists.
Okay.
Right now.
Thank you. That does make sense. All right. So, in a roundabout way. Yes. Okay. Looking forward, this is another question. If you've got any more of these, please just raise them up and we'll gather them up and hopefully get to them. Looking forward, what do we have to look forward to in the next legislative session regarding these issues? That's a loaded question.
That's an odd question.
Yeah, I mean, so probably a little early to say what they're going to write, bill-wise or propose. I can speak a little bit about the dynamics. So as some of you may have been following over the last 2 years, we have redrawn Montana's congressional and legislative maps. Well, we only had one congressional district, now we have two, so that was a fairly easy decision. But we redrew all of our legislative districts, as the state does supposedly every 10 years. It's not exactly 10 years. And that happens through what is called the Districting and Apportionment Commission, which is a five-person panel composed of two Republicans, two Democrats, and one nonpartisan chair. And to make a years-long process short, basically, they redrew the maps in a way that, in like a vacuous political environment in which no other factors exist, based purely on past voting behavior, an aggregate, really, of past voting behavior, Democrats should do better over the next 10 years in Montana than they have over the last 10 years. I mean, they're also pretty much as bad as they could be right now. So, like, it can't get much worse. They could be Wyoming, where there's, like, two of them. But the maps are favorable, not in the sense that they'll get a majority, but, like, over the next decade, they could, in theory, get, like, say, 10 more seats. And that sounds insignificant, but, again, going back to the idea of a supermajority, that has huge implications for what kind of constitutional referenda the legislature tries to put on the ballot, and I think it's probably fair to say that it will also tamp down the sort of partisan intensity of some of the legislation, just because there, like, is going to be a more political diversity in the legislature. But one kind of interesting caveat that I actually heard, like, on the record from Republican leaders this year when we were doing sort of postmortem interviews about the session, is the high volume of Republicans this year. And some of them made things a little bit harder for the GOP to pass because there's so much infighting within the caucus that, like, having more Republicans, if you're a Republican, is great to a point. And then there's enough Republicans where you start to see the differences in their personal politics, and that becomes an issue. So, like, it's interesting to hear, to think about, could more conservative policies be passed with fewer Republicans who are disciplined to vote together because there's not as many of them. I don't really know. But basically, there are likely to be more Democrats in the legislature over the next 10 years. The demographic changes in Missoula and Bozeman contribute to that, undoubtedly. The demographic changes in the Flathead will probably slow that down. And if you're looking at the three, you know, kind of fast-growing places in Montana. As to whether they are pursuing these same kinds of legislation in 2025, I think it depends a lot on what cues Trump gives. I mean, if you want to look at this in a really meta scale, I mean, that's where a lot of this comes back to, right? 2016, and right? Yeah, 16?
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. And the campaign that preceded that election. Obviously, Trump is going to be on the ballot. I think a lot of the cues that legislators and the grassroots and the money in D.C. and in Virginia take will be from the president, and that will have, I think, a huge impact on what kind of bills they bring in 25. Beyond that, I'm not really sure.
No, that's great. I would just add that I think, too, I mean, Montana's, you know, more firmly now a part of this conversation nationally. I mean, you know, we're mentioned in the same breath in talking about lawsuits regarding drag bans as Tennessee, Florida, Texas. I think that, you know, that puts us on a map for national organizations that, you know, are friendly to and supportive of, you know, particular agendas. I mean, this was the first... We've had, you know, charter school bills dropped in, Lord, every session that I think I've covered since 2009. This was the first time that we saw national groups like the National Alliance for Public Charter Schools dropping into the state with lobbying dollars and being a presence in the Capitol. And, that's a semi-related, you know, school choice movement. But that, I think, is, you know, those types of indicators. I mean, Montana's on the road, on the national roadmap now for a lot of these issues. And I think, you know, that a lot of eyes turn to Montana then. And that's just going to continue next session, I think. Mm-hmm. So we might see some, you know, activity in the hallways, too.
Mm-hmm. So. And as you guys probably know, on the federal level, the Senate race is all but certainly going to break spending and fundraising records in Montana, as have the last several. And I think the importance of Tester to both Republicans and Democrats nationally, whether they want to beat him or save him, is also going to contribute to some of this stuff. Like, I mean, I think the days of Montana being like a sort of an insular political environment, to the extent that it ever was, aren't over. I think the money is like here to stay. It's harder to control and track than ever. And I think everything from the U.S. Senate to state Supreme Court races to legislative races to school board races, at least in this current era of American politics, are you know, going to look much as they do currently for at least a few more years.
The narrative.
The estimation is that there will be $200 million coming into Montana on Tester's Senate race.
Yeah.
That includes PACs and stuff like that. That's not just donations.
Yeah. It's a lot of money. And I mean, in the 18 race was also huge.
The 12 race.
The 12 race, yeah. I mean, every race that Tester has run in has been really close and really expensive. And this will certainly be the most expensive, if not the closest, if he wins at all. So, yeah.
Okay, thanks. I'm told this is our last question. So, I think it's a good one. Why do you think that none of the amendments to the Montana Constitution passed?
Ooh.
Was that expected, even by the proponents, just to bring the issue to the public, and then it could be brought forth in the future? So maybe the first part of that question is where we should focus. Why do we think that none of the amendments to the Montana Constitution passed?
I'll answer the second part of that, first part of that question, which is that most of the proponents did not really think that these would pass, and would say that openly. The reason is it's practical. It's hard. It requires a two-thirds vote of the legislature. The math is a little weird. It's not two-thirds of each chamber. It's two-thirds of all 150 people in aggregate. And that was the significance. I mean, Democrats breathlessly warned of a total overhaul of the Constitution if Republicans got their supermajority. Because, as I said earlier, well, I'll elaborate a little bit. Basically, to pass a constitutional amendment, which does not amend the Constitution, it puts the question to the voters. This is something that a lot of Democrats have openly lied about. It requires a two-thirds vote of the legislature to put that question on the ballot in the forthcoming election, right? And that is two-thirds of 150 is 100. And Republicans had 102 members this session. And as I alluded to earlier, within those 102 members, there are factions. Some of them are like moderate, hardline in a relative sense. Some of them are smaller factions, more nuanced. But basically, it's a lot of competing interests. And it's just really hard to get 102 people to do the same thing every time. Because like, in order for these things to pass, like not only like the vote that matters is the final vote on the floor, but before they get to that point, there's any number of votes in committee and on the floor that they have to take as well, and so it requires keeping the ranks together in all of those votes as well as the final votes. And there were some instances in which constitutional amendments died, but that through parliamentary theatrics they were able to revive them, and then they died again. Like, it's just really hard to do. And it's also, I mean, I think a lot of people looked at the 2022 elections where Montanans defeated two constitutional amendments and reelected a Supreme Court justice as an indicator that people maybe don't want to make the kind of institutional changes that some Republican lawmakers want. So I think there's like a question about, people legitimately question whether their constituents wanted them to do this. So there's some of that. Some lawmakers legitimately believe that it's the wrong thing to do, and that and that the Constitution is good as it is. I mean, I think that was like kind of the general impression of leadership. Like, they might make some overtures to the rank and file members and say, "Yeah, we'll let you propose this, but like, we're probably not going to bail you out because it's a huge lift logistically," and that. And that, of course, doesn't even guarantee that you accomplish anything, because it still has to go to the voters. And ballot initiatives are infamously, when they get to the ballot, matters of marketing, because it's really hard to actually tell what they're going to do based on like the two paragraphs of text that are provided if you're not a lawyer. And then they have like the arguments attached, and you can choose to believe them or not. So it's really just about who spends the most money to convince people that this is going to do what they say it does on the airwaves. I think like the, what was LR-131, the Born Alive, whatever, in 2022, became like a referendum on abortion, even though that's not really what it did. But that's like the closest analog that people can understand. So there's concern even among supporters of ballot initiative or constitutional amendment ballot initiatives that they lose the narrative once it lands on the ballot, because it's up to anybody to interpret at that point. More so it's, I don't think leadership was super enthusiastic about it. I don't think the governor's office was super enthusiastic about it. And there's just not enough consensus among those 102 Republicans to pass something that requires so much discipline in the ranks, basically. Like, I wish there was like a broader ideological takeaway or like a philosophical takeaway, but I think it's just really hard to do.
Alex, anything you want to add to that?
Not really. Just that I think anytime you ask someone to, amend a constitution, they don't take it. Like, there are a lot of lawmakers that I've talked to who would not take that lightly. Mm-hmm. And there are plenty of parts of the Montana Constitution that those lawmakers really like. Like the local control for school boards. That's
right. Like, it's, when people hear amend the Montana Constitution, they think they're coming for stream access, they're coming for clean and healthful environment, et cetera, et cetera. But, the Constitution is a lot more than that. Like, it also has some, like, pretty regressive stuff, like, that, conservatives might like. I mean, there's, like, things in there, about gay marriage and stuff historically that have been an ongoing theme in Montana. So it's not just that it...
they're aware that it's not just the grabby headline stuff that's in there. And, you know, like there was talk at some point among Democrats who were trying to fundraise on this idea that Republicans would open up a constitutional convention, which is like kind of ridiculous. Like, I think most Republicans know that that opens up a whole can of worms that they're not going to be able to like close. And that also, like, do they even want to go through a constitutional convention, which is like a huge investment, you know, in time and energy and money. And then they have to get passed by the voters. Like, again, it's issues of practicality.
All right, thank you. I think that's going to be the close of our program for tonight. Just a couple things. Again, thank you to the Bozeman Public Library for having us. Really appreciate this opportunity. Just shameless plug part for Montana Free Press. If you're not reading Montana Free Press, I encourage you to do so. It, as the name implies, free. You can go onto our website at any time and write the good work that these folks are doing, as well as several other reporters trying to do our best to cover the issues important to Montana. There's no requirement that you pay for that. There is an option for anybody to subscribe. You can, if you're interested in giving $1 a month, you can do that. If you're interested in giving more than that, you certainly can. But as the name implies, you don't have to. It's free. The idea of a free press is that the people of this state should have the opportunity to be informed about what's going on in their communities, and that's what we strive to do. There are some newsletters that we put out, again, free to sign up for. There is a morning newsletter. You can sign up for these things in the back on your way out if you're inclined. Morning newsletter will include the stories that would have published on our website during the day. We run once every week on Fridays a newsletter called The Lowdown that is some of a recap, but it's also the things that our staff thinks about that they feel is important for our readership to be knowledgeable about. And so those are often a little maybe shorter takes than what you might see in a full-blown story, but a lot of information packed into that. Then every Thursday, Arne produces...
The best one.
A newsletter called Capitalize that really focuses on news that's happening out of the Capitol, politics in our state. If you're interested in that stuff, you're not going to read anything better in the state than what Arne's producing once a week.
And we just hit 5,000 subscribers, so thank you.
Thanks. All right, thank you, everybody. We'll stick around a little bit as you're just walking out. If anybody has any further questions, concerns they want to chat about with us, we'd be happy to.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
That was a presentation by staff from the Montana Free Press about bills from the 2023 Montana legislative session that impacted the First Amendment in Montana libraries. The presentation was hosted by the Bozeman Public Library as part of their Banned Books Week programs on October 3rd, 2023, in the community room at the library.